AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening to Women Who Travel. We hope that you enjoy this podcast as much as we enjoy creating it. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Today, we'll share a rerun of one of my favorites. In this episode, Dr. Orna Goralnik, host of Showtime's Couples Therapy, shares how travel is beneficial for relationships. Very fitting as we begin to travel for the holidays. Enjoy your Thanksgiving celebrations, wherever they may be, and we'll see you next week. Hello, I'm Lale Arikoglu, and this is Women Who Travel, a podcast for anyone who's curious about the world. Like many people, I'm not really a fan of Valentine's Day and all its forced expectations. It's just not really my scene. And here on this podcast, we're avoiding the cliches: the heart-shaped food, expensive dinner reservations, and useless presents. But we do have a gift on offer. We're lucky to have a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who has deep insights into all things love and travel. She's Dr. Orna Goralnik, the host of Showtime's documentary series, Couples Therapy. And the good news is, she believes travel is beneficial to a relationship.
Travel is like extremely important, and it can offer like a great space for growth and change. I think couples do amazing work sometimes when they get out of their habits. Eating different kinds of food, anything that gets you out of like a ritualistic, habitual way of thinking and behaving can open up new ways of thinking, new ways of hearing, new ways of understanding, offering new parts of yourself, getting connected to parts of you that you're not usually in touch with. And that allows people to get in touch with their better parts so that they can really work something out or find a good space within themselves where they can give more or hear more.
Travel can often feel like an escape from reality. It's easier to be your better self when you're, say, eating a gelato on the Piazza San Marco or zipping down a ski slope. Or, if you're like me, falling into the sleepy rhythm of moving from the beach to the bar every day. If you're traveling solo, you might feel a bit more spontaneous when it comes to meeting someone new. But that can also put a lot of pressure when you return to the doldrums of everyday life on the other side of a trip. Orna Goralnik's Couples Therapy shows that simply stepping into her office is a journey of its own kind. So you've been traveling all around, talking about your show, Couples Therapy, which is on Showtime. Tell me and tell listeners a little bit about the show. I am fascinated to know how you find the couples.
I just show up and they're at my door, but we have a fantastic team of people. Each season they get probably like 1,000 couples, and then a few hundred get kind of initially interviewed, and eventually like a few people are selected to actually do the season.
I'm really interested because you can feel so vulnerable when you're in front of a camera at the best of times. And then to put yourself in a vulnerable position of having to talk about your relationship and be so a moment of such honesty, do you find that the couples you speak with adapt and get used to the camera? Does the camera become their friend?
First of all, the way the office is designed is when you're in the office, you don't see cameras. They have this brilliant kind of set design where you're just in a beautiful office that feels like just a lovely, cozy place to be, a very safe space to be. And neither I nor the couples see the cameras.
Orna's job requires her to be a keen observer and listener, skills she credits to having lived in multiple countries as an American Israeli. She describes herself as a wanderer.
I was born in the States and then moved to Israel as a kid and then lived in a few other places, and then ultimately came back to the States for grad school. And I also come from a family where people travel a lot, and I've always traveled a lot. My kids travel a lot. I mean, it's like, it's sort of in our blood. It's also part of being like Israeli. I mean, Israelis travel like crazy. I think both living in different countries and switching between languages and between cultures, and then in a way living long enough that I've seen each of these cultures change. Israel's changed so much, and the United States has changed so much too. Again, I've lived in other places in Europe.
You grew up for most of your life in Israel. Now you live in the US. And I pulled a quote that I'm going to kind of paraphrase, but that you sort of described the experience of moving between countries as kind of putting you in a position where you're always on some level watching and observing and trying to make sense of what you're seeing, which was very good preparation for being an analyst.
I think it happens to most people that travel and switch between cultures and languages, is that you never take your own discourse as the ultimate gospel and the ultimate truth. In a way, you always know that there's a different way. There's a different way to say things. There are different habits that are the right norms. There's a different way to think about things. There are different ideologies that will then shape how you experience any one event. So nothing is just the ultimate truth, which first of all makes it easy then to understand why, like, two people in a couple can have some difficulty understanding each other or working from different assumptions. And then to try to kind of imagine how to translate and bridge between and compare. And I think it makes one less dogmatic. And I think that's one of the reasons people love traveling so much, which is that it immediately disembeds them or pulls them out of their most immediate experience and exposes them to something new and different. And in that sense, changes them.
As someone who also grew up in a country outside of the US and then moved here and ultimately found their current partner here, what cultural differences have you observed when it comes to relationships between Israel and the US or other countries you've lived in? And also how people talk about their relationships?
I don't like stereotypes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can say pretty obvious things, which is that Americans have a way of, at least on the surface, wrapping their interactions with, in a way, a more friendly, patient wrapping. So in a certain way, conversations are easier for Americans. There's a certain expectation of friendliness. Israelis, on the other hand, they're not friendly, but they're very, very direct. So they talk about the things that matter to them with a lot more self-disclosure and directness. They get to the point, and it makes it in a way more heated, but they get to the heart of the matter more.
It's funny that you describe those two dichotomies, because it's, as a British person, I feel like I'm deeply unconfrontational and also unable to talk about my feelings.
I can tell you that when I lived in England, I ultimately left. I could not actually decode what people mean.
Yeah.
There was so much coding, repression, kind of a certain kind of subversive humor that made it very difficult for me to understand what people actually want.
Yeah, there's like three different layers you have to break down through before you get to the meaning. My aunt lived in Tel Aviv, so I got to go to Israel a few times and spend lots of time with her and her friends. And the Israeli directness was something I came to know and love. When I was reading the New Yorker profile of you, that you choose to not be particularly forthcoming with your own personal life because it's not particularly helpful in your work. But I am interested to know, as someone who grew up traveling and clearly it's a big part of your life, what purpose does it serve for you now, today?
Yeah, I have an insatiable wanderlust and want to travel all the time. It's always like a huge learning experience, like learning about a different culture. how people live, the politics of the place, the kind of things that matter to people. You know, I love going into bookstores, even if I don't understand the language, just seeing what people are reading. Beauty. Beauty of a different place, of a different country or a different continent has like a huge influence over me. I find it very nourishing, inspiring. I think it's just the learning and the newness and the surprise that a different place introduces. It just opens up a space inside me, and it's inspiring. I learn from it, I grow from it, and I come back both nurtured by it, but also kind of open in a way to the people I work with to hear them differently somehow.
It sounds like travel helps you understand people better and the people you work with.
Yeah, travel opens you up.
After the break, how to negotiate your differences on vacation and whether springing a surprise trip on your other half is actually ever a good idea.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tyres, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Since a therapy session can start with anything that the couple wants to bring up, the format of Orna's show opens up many conversations. And there's an episode where there's a couple and one half of the couple surprises the other with a dominatrix, from what I recall.
Right.
Obviously very different from a surprise trip, but can surprises ever be good, or are you always, is it a self-serving gift in a relationship? Does a surprise trip actually work out? Should you give someone one?
Surprises can be wonderful, and surprise trips can be wonderful. I mean, it depends on who the people are. I mean, some people, it's easy for them to shift gears, and they love the idea that someone else thought about them in this way that they didn't. Some people can find surprises super flattering, like a real gift, a real give. Not a selfish give, but a real give, that someone will think about all the details and not bother them with it and just present them with something wonderful. But, you know, you need a certain level of flexibility to be able to move with a surprise and not to need to be in control and to know in advance. Some people are more rigid or have a lot of trouble with it, and they find surprises overwhelming and impossible to cope with. So it really varies between one person and the next, but I'd say some surprises are fantastic.
I do. I'm someone who does love surprises. Often I think in a partnership, there's one person who loves traveling and the adventure that comes with travel a lot more than the other half. What's your advice for someone who's in a relationship where they love to travel and it's a huge part of their life and their partner isn't interested in it?
I mean, all differences between couples are a challenge. This one can sometimes be quite a challenge because it's big. When people like to travel, it's an important part of them. And the reason people like to travel is they like to be exposed to new things. And people who don't like to travel, it's a big difference. It's not just, you know, do I like, pears versus apples. It's like a big part of the psyche if you like to travel versus not. It connects to deep issues. The way I would try to think about it is to try out what works better. Is that like a kind of difference where it's good to work towards doing things separately? So the person who likes to travel gets to travel a lot, but not with their partner. Or is it the kind of difference where meeting in the middle actually will promote growth for both people, so that the person who might be anxious about traveling or not like it might grow to benefit more from travel, more than they expected? Do they need their partner to do certain things to make it easier for them, like to be the one that's planning it, or to plan the kind of travel that will accommodate the other person's aversion? What are they averse to? What is the issue? Do they need to get more involved in the planning so they feel more comfortable? I mean, does the person who likes to travel a lot, are they, I don't know, avoiding something else by traveling? I mean, is there a way to find a compromise? Or is it the kind of difference that it's best to just let people do their separate things?
And I guess there is also value in having something that's yours alone in a relationship, right? That, you know, if
Absolutely.
Travel is your thing, you can go off and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Is that a hard thing, do you think, for couples to communicate to each other in a way that doesn't feel hurtful? That they have something that the other person doesn't have to be a part of? Or that they don't want them to be a part of?
Couples get tripped up in communicating about their differences. It's easy for people to interpret difference as somehow something frightening or potentially insulting or injurious or rejecting. It's hard for people to just see difference in a neutral way. So, you know, I can imagine someone saying, well, why don't I travel on my own? Someone else somehow receiving it as a rejection, or, oh, you don't want my company, or you don't want to do what I want to do. Like, it's easy to interpret things as hurtful or insulting. So I think going about it gingerly. And trying to communicate where you're coming from and keeping in mind how the other might interpret it and being patient, understanding misinterpretations would be helpful.
Do you think that booking a trip together is a way to sometimes create a space to solve things or work through things? You know, I feel like it's quite a common scenario when a relationship's getting a little bit challenging and people decide to, you know, take some time away for themselves together.
Absolutely.
Why do you think that has value?
First of all, because distractions are removed and people have time. They might be exposed to beauty and to things that are aesthetically pleasing whether it's nature or art or a beautiful city. I think getting away from habits, the habits of daily living, whether it's work or just one's rituals, I think that's why travel is like extremely important, and it can offer like a great space for growth and change. I think couples do amazing work sometimes when they get out of their habits.
Is it a challenge then when you return back to the doldrum of everyday life?
Yes. Yes, it is. I mean, it's interesting. In the season that we recorded, not this season now, the season before that's coming out in April, there's exactly that. There's a couple that were going through a lot, and then they took a big safari trip to Africa and had like a profound experience with each other and reconnected and everything. And then they got back and they're like, life was right back there, and they were right back in their thing, but with a kind of a connection, a memory of what just recently happened, how things can be different between them and the thing about them that really connects them. So, yeah.
As you were saying this, I was thinking, I was like, huh, yeah, I guess there is that phrase, like the honeymoon period is over, and it's kind of that.
Right.
There's a reason for it. After the break, responses to our request for listener stories about love and travel.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
David had insisted I join him on a literacy project based in Afua, which is in the far eastern part of Zambia. I, a smartly dressed non-camping girl, was not interested. I declined the job several times until I had no choice but to go. Our project was on an encampment set up on the banks of the Luangwa River. We had each our own tents and shared a communal camp kitchen with the rest of the project team. Little were we to know that an encounter with elephants would change everything and set us on a course to romance and marriage. The local camp staff had warned us that there were elephants in the area and that we should never leave unattended food in the kitchen, as it would attract them. Sure enough, when preparing lunch on the first day, an elephant came into the camp and helped herself to all the fresh vegetables I had bought earlier. That night, we diligently packed our food away for safekeeping in the camp storeroom. All, that is, except for one onion. The elephants returned to the camp that night at about 2 a.m. They walk almost silently, their big feet padding gently over the ground. One whiff of that pesky onion brought the whole herd into our camp kitchen. Our tents were lined up beside the kitchen, and for 30 minutes of shock and awe, all we could do was peep out through an open zip and watch six or seven elephants go on a rampage until they found that onion. They trashed the kitchen, smashing every plate, cup, and bowl I had personally bought. After picking up all the broken kitchenware, we both spent the rest of the night huddled up by the camp reception, absorbing what had just happened and wondering if the elephants would reappear. It was during these moments that I saw David as just David, not a work colleague. We both set our guard down. We had a common purpose, to survive camp life among the wild animals. From then on, each time one of us picked up a cracked bowl, a handleless cup, we would both laugh so hard as it seemed so funny now. David made me dinner the next night, a French-style chicken dish cooked in wine with garlic, but without any fresh vegetable. It was our first friendly meal together, the first of many. The elephants had unlocked something in both of us. From that day, I never walked alone around the camp. David was always there by my side, just in case I bumped into an elephant. In the evenings, the sunset, would always sit together, and we spent more time cooking together at the camp kitchen. While one cooked, the other washed out for the naughty elephants. Our experience with the elephants bonded us and set us up on a journey of romance that led to our marriage. And the moral from this tale is, if he doesn't say, "I told you so," after the elephants have trashed your china, keep your eye on him. He may turn out to be the man for you.
Responding to your request for stories about breakups during a trip. And I had the ultimate breakup. My husband told me that he wanted a divorce. The one and only time so far I've gone to Paris. It apparently was prompted by a book I gave him to read on the plane that was popular at the time, which was Mitch Albom's Tuesdays with Maury, because he was constantly complaining that he needed something to read on the plane, but he needed something that was short and sort of easy to get through. So I bought him this on the recommendation of a male friend at work, and I was surprised to see him really get into it on the plane ride over to Paris. And after we landed and had a bite to eat and we were walking back to our hotel, I asked him what he thought of the book, and he gave it rave reviews. I was so happy to hear this because that wasn't usually his style. And he continued by saying that it really got him to thinking about a lot of important topics and what's important in his life. And based upon all of that, he told me within 7 hours of landing in Paris that he wanted a divorce. So I went back to the hotel, packed up my stuff, and left the next day. I knew the marriage and my dreams of a romantic trip were just ruined. And there was just no way I could stay. It wasn't even a possibility for me. Besides the hurt and resentment I was feeling for him at telling me where and when he did, I just couldn't imagine enjoying myself on any basis. I couldn't think of any kind of consolation prize that would make it okay to stay. Travel is something that is emotional for me. No matter who I'm with or even if I'm by myself, it just connotes connection, discovery, rich experiences. And for him, he's just more practical. He thought since we'd already prepaid for a lot of the hotel and the excursions, leaving would be just an irresponsible thing to do. And he stayed and, as far as I know, enjoyed himself. As I've been thinking about this, I guess I honestly have to say that I didn't want to stay because I didn't want to ruin Paris. I already thought my marriage was ruined. I'd never been to Paris. And I just thought that if I stayed under the circumstances, it wasn't doing myself or Paris any favors. It was sort of a disservice to the city that I dreamed about being in. I want to preserve it for the future when I could enjoy it. I'm not really sure if that's selfish, but I have to say I don't regret it.
This happened over 20 years ago. I've never been back to Paris, but I am finally planning that long-anticipated trip as a solo traveler. Since the pandemic, I've sort of had an attitude of, if not now, when? And I'm looking forward to my trip to Paris this year in 2023.
Travel can be a test for even the strongest of relationships. I mean, who hasn't had an argument with a loved one in an airport, or during hour six of a very long car ride, or over directions in a new city, like I did in Athens one time? Sometimes it can also just be spending just too much time together. Traveling as a couple on a trip, there is sometimes, even if you are in the best place your relationship has ever been, such a forced intimacy.
Yeah, you can get sick of your traveling companion in a big way.
Right. I mean, I've stayed in hotel rooms where there's no door on the bathroom because it's some crazy design feature. And I'm always just like, look, I love my husband, but I do not want to hear him going to the toilet on my like romantic trip.
I understand.
Is there a way to kind of productively have alone time on those sorts of trips?
It's hugely important. I think that should be like a thing people always agree to in advance, which is we got to make sure we take some time to spend apart. Hugely important. Yeah, because no matter how much you love a person, whether it's your love partner, your kid, your best friend, I mean, day in, day out, seeing them like under the stressors of travel, no time to yourself, none of your usual habits that ground you in your own mind. I mean, you're going to turn on each other at some point. I mean, you're going to get sick of each other at some point. And it's very important to schedule some time alone. There's just no way around it.
I feel like what you just described was like the last couple of years for a lot of couples.
Yeah. Yeah.
So time alone on a trip is maybe more important than ever.
Yes.
Seems like sane advice. Look out for season 4 of Couples Therapy out soon. The first 3 seasons are currently available on streaming and on-demand platforms for all Showtime subscribers. Next week, we're speaking with an intrepid Brazilian journalist, Eliane Brum, who moved from the big city and built a recycled house in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, and whose noisiest neighbors are howler monkeys. Thank you for listening. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me, as always, on Instagram at Lale Hannah, and follow along with Women Who Travel on Instagram at Women Who Travel. You can also join the conversation in our Facebook group. Alison Leighton Brown is our composer. Jennifer Nelson is our engineer. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.